So even though Piers was the one who introduced the word pragmatism as his new theory of meaning in 1878, later, I think about 1905, he was troubled by the use of his ideas by William James, and so he then called his view pragmatism. He said, which is an ugly enough term that it's safe from kidnapping. Who's going to want to pick up a term like that? Well, for our purposes, pragmatism is just fine as a general umbrella for Piers and James and Dewey, because they all, in one form or another, despite their differences in emphasis, held to the pragmatic maxim, which I'll mention in just a second. Piers looked more scientific when he used the pragmatic maxim. William James, more psychological and subjective. John Dewey, more social. So if you distinguish science, psychology, and social application, then you get something of the differences between these pragmatists. But they all held to the pragmatic maxim. And I quote, "In order to ascertain the meaning of an intellectual conception, one should consider what practical consequences might conceivably result by necessity from the truth of that conception. And the sum of these consequences will constitute the entire meaning of the conception." Let me give that to you again. You may not want to write it all down, but the first part you should get. In order to ascertain the meaning of an intellectual conception, one should consider what practical consequences, might conceivably result by necessity from the truth of that conception. And then he said the sum of those consequences is the entire meaning of it. So the meaning equals consequence, practical consequence. That's what you want to make sure you pick up here. The pragmatic maxim is the meaning of a conception is its practical consequences. And later, when Piers refined this pragmatic maxim and he wanted to state it so it wouldn't be so subject to easy refutation, he allowed that the practical consequences include hypotheticals, would-be's, if you will. The practical consequence of a statement about the bones of some pharaoh being buried in a pyramid. The practical consequences of that, for me, are probably nil, right? But if you include would-be's, hypotheticals, then the practical consequences, and if you were to be at this pyramid and to dig through this entranceway and so forth and so on, then you would encounter certain sensibles like bones that are dry and blah, 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 okay? So practical consequences don't simply mean, you know, how will this affect you this weekend when you have some free time? Don't overdo your reading of practical consequences here. He would allow for, if you did the following, hypothetically, this is what you would encounter. But the main point is, meaning is consequence, practical consequence. According to Piers, there are three categories that any adequate philosophical analysis must deal with. He liked to call these firstness, secondness, and thirdness. That is, moving from one level of adequacy to another to cover something. Any adequate philosophical discussion or analysis must deal with quality, firstness, then reaction to quality, and then generality. Now, maybe I have this wrong. I'm not an expert in Piers, but that sounds like, in a vague way, Hegel, doesn't it? You have the quality, the reaction to the quality, and then you have something which generalizes that encompasses it all? I don't know. Maybe not. Anyway, Pierce said that he found these categories by means of a phenomenology of his own experience. If you do an internal investigation of what he called the phaneron, P-H-A-N-E-R-O-N, no one else uses this vocabulary. It's very distinctive to peers. A phaneron is that which is open to sight, that which is manifest in any awareness of something. And so if you look at, if you introspect and do an examination of the phaneron, he said you'll find these categories of quality, reaction, and generality. The reason past philosophies have been so inadequate is that they don't look at all three of those categories, but usually only the first or second. Okay, a third element in Pierce's thought that you want to note, the first one was the pragmatic maxim, secondly this notion of the three categories in any adequate philosophical analysis. And now the third is his view that the future is open. The future is open. Pierce held strongly to a doctrine of chance. He actually labeled his view of history tychism, T-Y-C-H-I-S-M. It comes from the Greek word for chance. Tychism. According to him, there are real events in this universe that have no causal antecedent. See, he believed in chance. In the literal sense, believed that there are things that happen that have no causal antecedent. But in the midst of this universe that is characterized by tychism, chance, regularities tend to grow. There are some there's a lot of novelty, a lot of chance, and there's some regularity. But as history goes on, there are more and more regularities. And these regularities, he maintains, have emerged from a succession of what were originally novel occurrences. And this is utter nonsense. I mean, how can I be kind about this, really? I have to be blunt. If they are novel, how do they become regular? The first time you have a similarity between one event and another, it's lost its novelty altogether. So, if you were to be really serious about tychism, you'd have to say that there could never be similarities. If you begin with novel events, they can never repeat. There can be no commonality between events. The minute they repeat, they lose their novelty. Anyway, on his view, laws can then evolve. You can start with a universe that's chance, and from the chance universe, laws can evolve. The reason I'm stopping to be critical of this and to be bluntly critical is because those of you who have followed my apologetical teaching know that this is one of the main tools I use in arguing with people. When they maintain that there's no sovereign God who created and controls the universe, that things happen randomly, then immediately I'm going to start working on them. There are different ways to do it, but in one way or another to say, well, then there can be no laws in your universe. Because everything's got to be what? Novel. Everything's got to be individual. Everything's got to be different. There can be no universals, no commonalities, no similarities in a universe that's utterly random. Something else about Pierce in terms of his psychology of man, he refused to compartmentalize the faculties of man into reason, will, and feeling. That is, he really opposed what's called faculty psychology. The man has the faculty of reasoning, the faculty of willing, the faculty of feeling. He believed that these three all interpenetrate with one another, and it's utterly arbitrary to try to distinguish them in separate categories. Peirce maintained that no system of philosophy and no science can ever be completed, that all of our intellectual work must be, all of our theoretical work must be tentative. Everything that we have maintained as to our theory of reality or how we know what we know is fallible and corrigible, subject to change and correction. And the name he gave to this is the doctrine of fallibilism. Everything is fallible. Well, fascinating philosopher. I wish we had more time for him. Of course, I'll be saying that more and more as the course gets closer to being completed and I have to condense my notes. But a lot of interesting things here in him. In Peirce, I would think you would especially be fascinated by his admission that everything that men say in their theories is fallible, open to correction, that there is a real element of chance, real, literal chance that operates in the universe, that we need to make our philosophy responsive to the practicalities of life. The meaning of a term is its practical consequences. Well, let me move on to the second well-known pragmatist, and this would be William James. William James, who lived from 1842 to 1910. William James was an American psychologist and philosopher. He graduated in 1869 from Harvard with a degree in medicine. In 1873, he was appointed to teach comparative anatomy at Harvard. In 1875, he was appointed professor of psychology at Harvard. And 10 years later, professor of philosophy at Harvard. Now, depending on where you're coming from, that either says a whole lot for him or against him. I mean, I think you have to be somewhat impressed. Here's a man who can have a degree in medicine, be a professor of psychology, professor of philosophy, and at no less an institution as Harvard. That's quite a lifetime. Some of his better-known works, Principles of Psychology, 1890, 2 volumes. The Will to Believe, 1897. Pragmatism, 1907. The Varieties of Religious Experience, 1902. A Pluralistic Universe, 1909. The Meaning of Truth, 1909. Some Problems in Philosophy, 1911. And then the last one I'll mention, 1912, Essays in Radical Empiricism. Now, I don't rattle off these titles for the philosophers we've been studying of late, just so you'll have an idea that they wrote some books, and there were a lot of them in many cases. Often the titles are a clue to you about what they focused on and also what sometimes is distinctive. Their outlook. So that if you get an exam question that says the author of Essays in Radical Empiricism had a view of meaning that was set over against whom, then you're going to have to know that it's William James who is the author of Essays in Radical Empiricism. Or if I were to say the author of Radical Empiricism, or the person who used that terminology, and the person who used the terminology of phrenology, how did they differ, where was their falling out, and so forth. So anyway, you do want to pay attention to some of these terminological and also publication distinctives for the various people we're looking at. William James dedicated his volume on pragmatism to John Stuart Mill. That should tell you something. And it's primarily William James who established pragmatism in America, being a professor at Harvard University. John Dewey will become the most influential pragmatist, but it's James, more than Beers, that established pragmatism and on the American horizon, if you will. And let me give you a quotation from James. "The meaning of any proposition can always be brought down to some particular consequence in our future practical experience, whether passive or active." Let me give it to you again. "The meaning of any proposition can always be brought down to some particular consequence in our future practical experience, whether passive or active." Passive, what would happen to me if certain things happen? Active, if I were to go out and do the following. "The meaning of a proposition comes down to its practical consequence in our future," I'll get it right, "particular consequence in our future practical experience." Well, hopefully you can see immediately that there's a lot in common between William James and Charles Peirce then. William James held that anything meaningful must have some influence on our practical experience. Anything meaningful must have some kind of consequence in experience. Or to use his language, ideas must have cash value. Any idea will be right or true if it has fruitful consequences. If the cash value, to mix the metaphor, is fruitful. Now you understand cash value is a metaphor. This is not crass. Any idea, the meaning of an idea, has got to be able to be sold for money. But if you want to know the value of this book, okay, or the value of a pair of shoes, we sometimes say, well, we can compare them in terms of their cash value. You know, you can get $25 for the shoes and $3 for the used book. So what does that tell you? Well, that metaphor of cash value is used, that he said any idea must have cash value, and those ideas which are true are fruitful ideas. And in particular, William James wanted to find the cash value of metaphysical concepts and terms. All metaphysical disputes, he says, can either be resolved or trivialized by examining the practical consequences of alternative answers. The practical consequences of alternative answers. So you have, in the history of philosophy, these grand schemes of metaphysics, theories of reality, or who man is, and what's the cosmos, what's the natural world, so forth. And William James, as you can see, would be very popular because with students and the populace as a whole, he said, look, you can decide which metaphysic is right, or you can resolve the difference between them by saying, well, now, what do they come down to? What if two people have really different sounding, highfalutin conceptions of the nature of reality? And they look real different, but when all is said and done, they both come down to you would be better off to cooperate with the state rather than to rebel against the state. William James would tend to say, you see, there's really nothing to choose between here. They have the same cash value. The meaning of things, you're beginning to get the point, the meaning of things is only found in the outward operations and experiences of life, the practicalities that you would experience or be engaged in. This represents a high level of anti-intellectualism and what is called nominalism in philosophy. If you haven't had the first course in our series, that may not mean a lot to you, but nominalists say words are detachable labels. There's nothing to a word. There's nothing that corresponds in essence to a word. A rose by any other name smells as sweet. Who cares if you call it a rose? Just a detachable label. You could call it manure and it would still smell as sweet. In the end, who cares what you call all these things about ultimate reality or man or nature and so forth? It all comes down to whether it smells sweet or otherwise. It's the practical consequences that are important. In particular, William James said, truth is a process. Truth is a process, a system of verifying things. A system of verifying things. Scientific theories are instruments to guide our future actions. They are not final answers to our questions about nature. And that's the great liberation of pragmatism, that now we don't have to worry about a final answer that describes nature correctly. What is the world like? What is real? We don't need final answers. We don't need a description because scientific theories are just instruments to guide our future actions. What we need is advice pointing the way. Here's the best way to get through life. Here's the best way to solve that problem. Here's how to live in this environment successfully. Scientific theories show us how to respond. They are not an attempt to give us a final answer as to the nature of things or to describe for us things. So truth is a process, and it's primarily the process or the system of verifying things. If an idea works when it's applied to experience, then it's true. Ideas are false when they have no practical value. Now, given that view of truth, truth is a process of verification. It's a process of learning what works, and false ideas are those which have no practical value, then truth becomes a matter of degree, doesn't it? Truth develops through time. You don't have any final established truth. You just have degrees of truth, and they change over time. Truth develops. James set forth a system that he called radical empiricism, which developed from the ideas of Charles Peirce. Radical empiricism. There's only one primal stuff. There's only one primal stuff, which he called pure experience. We don't have minds and matter, but rather mind and matter both are reducible to this primal stuff of experience. This is also called the doctrine of neutral monism. You've encountered this already. Neutral monism. We don't have minds and bodies, material bodies. We have experience. That's the primal stuff of reality. And it's neutral. It's one kind of thing, experience, and it's neutral as to being mind or body.